Hello and welcome to the Tech and Trees podcast. My name is Pascal Mies and today I'm starting a new season of Tech and Trees. After leaving Africa, I took a little pause to reflect on what I wanted to do next and what I wanted to learn about. However, in the end, everything here will still be about the questions of how do we build better climate tech and how do we build more of that faster. The focus is now shifting back to European climate tech though. I'll try and put a stronger focus on deep tech as well as hands-on learnings for operators in the climate tech startups out there while keeping a balance with a higher level investor interviews. This first one is one of the OGs in European climate tech, Hampus Jakobsson, the general partner and co-founder, or I should say a general partner and co-founder of the climate tech VC Pale Blue Dot. Our conversation spans Hampus's evening routine, Larry Fink's overestimation of the climate tech opportunity, as well as best and malpractices in the climate tech sector. After our call, Hampus apologized for being impossible to steer in a conversation. I think having a creative spirit like him on the pod is simply a guarantee for inspiring content. So sit back and enjoy listening to Hampus Jakobsson.
Welcome to Tech and Trees.
Hampus, so cool of you to take the time. Thank you so much. Lovely of you to be here. How are you today?
I'm good. I've been traveling the last days to some of our companies. I were in London and then in Paris, and I got to enjoy the Eurostar and like the whole kind of figuring out different countries, tube systems and everything. It's good. It's nice.
You got to experience the European train network, yeah?
Yeah, exactly. And I think that it's funny because I've been to Paris before, I've been to London before, of course, and a lot of times, but it's interesting when you kind of see the stark differences in one day. And it was the first time I did the Eurostar. So it was like really interesting just to like get the feeling of going from one culture and like what happens actually in the UK also politically and, where the sort of the climate is, literally the climate is, but also on like how much is the UK kind of owned by like a certain class and a certain group of people, and how I think that I get a feeling that like people are fairly disillusioned if they're not in power. And then you come to Paris and I think that Paris feels very different. It felt very much vibrant, and like talking to a lot of our French companies and like the difference where they feel that there's much more of a grassroots culture, and I think the politics in France is very much like a pro-climate, but also more geopolitical of like, we want to build our own industries that of course has very good implications for climate. So it was very, very interesting. Like, most of the times I've been London back and forth and, gotten that intravenously. But I think now it's interesting to just see the flip in one day, to just like have, dinners with somebody in London and talking about politics, and then breakfast somebody in London and talk about politics, and being like, interesting, this is the same conversation, but people are saying very different things. That was very, very nice.
Almost sounds as if, like in the UK, you still have remnants of the whole aristocrat kind of structure of society, while in France it sounds a bit more people driven, kind of like stemming from the revolutionary culture and so on.
I think that, I have worked both in Paris and London way back when, like 2000 in both countries. And I think that I felt that it's actually flipped, because when I worked in Paris, it was much more aristocratic in a sense. I had the much more feeling that it was like, this country is run by like, people have gone to the right schools, we know what we're doing. If you're not from there, you probably don't know. And I think when I was in London, it was more like worker culture of like, hey, we're building the new internet companies, nobody knows anything, we're the youth figuring shit out. And I think that I had that picture in me that France was a bit more like, let's meet on the right, like the right street, on the right place, and like talk on the right business. And if you're not on that street, you're actually nobody. And the interesting thing is like, now I actually feel like it feels that the wind has turned. Now I really feel like France has so much things going for it. And I think London is suffering, and England feels more suffering from the current wave of like populism, capitalism, headaches of like, I think that my feeling was that England has lost its narrative. Like it has lost its like, why should you care about England? Like care about yourself. Whereas I think that France very much has like a very strong like national pride and being like, we're going to build this country and we're going to build it the right way. We're going to figure out our energy markets. We're going to figure out like this and that. And you really feel that difference when you talk to people. And I think that used to be like back in the day when I worked there around 2000, I really felt it was not beneficial because when the internet came, you kind of like, I at least felt that don't build the French internet. Like this is ridiculous. And I think the UK were more like, hey, well, we'll bring this in. We'll adopt it. We'll build media companies. But now suddenly with climate, I think it's changed because now it almost feels like the UK feels like they're, you know, backpedaling and being like, oh, like we don't want to like adopt these new things and it's complicated. And they're promising the people like, oh, we won't have like meat taxes and like we won't force EVs on you and you can drive your big cars anywhere and whatever you want. And then you come to Paris and it's like, no, you can't have fossil fuel here. We're going to build our own electrical cars. And by the way, we have the grid is nuclear. And like you get this, like, it was very interesting feeling, both talking to like people in power, but also like the startups that are usually very young people that we work with. Like I felt a very nice vibe. So I'm coming like energized and like with new impressions from that, which was good. So
that sounds amazing. I could go on with you about that topic for a long time. I studied in both cities. So it's interesting to hear like what the climate scene has evolved into there.
Yeah, let's see.
But I'll maybe circle back to that later at this point. I actually have a few conversation starters for you, just for people to get to know you, for anyone who might not know you yet. And you're a founder, you're an investor, you're kind, I imagine you work a lot, right? So I tend to observe that people have a certain work personality. And then, you know, you also blog and you mentioned quite a lot that you like to cook, you're a father, right? You also run, for example. So could you like briefly describe for me, like what does Pale Blue Dot Hampus, so work Hampus, look like? And what does like family Hampus look like?
Yeah, it's like, I truly believe that most people are multiple personalities. Like I actually think that, you know, the whole adage about like you're one person walking down into the river and you're another person walking up out of the river. I really, really believe that any person is an emergent phenomenon of all the things happening in you. And it's very easy to like read a fiction book or watch a movie or land in a new city and actually shift your personality while you're doing that. And I actually think that most of us have a too strong belief that we have one solid identity. And I mean that in every single aspect. Like I think now, of course, now like the last 10 years, we can talk about gender, but I think there's so many aspects of this thing which boils down to anything. Oh, you're a very impulsive person. Wait, you're a very thorough person. This doesn't really make sense. Or, you know, like you're a very caring person, but well, you're also like a very business person. And like, wow. So I think that it's one of those things where I just see us as lots of different waves that are just multiplying with each other constantly. And then like different kind of moods and settings and situations makes one wave stronger than another. And I think, you know, you could call me a split personality syndrome person, but I do think that everybody's like that. I don't think that it's only me that is essentially. I think that more people should stop saying he or she and they should say they, not because of gender, just because of recognizing that you're not probably one person. You're probably multiple people, honestly, inside. You just happen to have one body. And I think, of course, all of us only have one body. So I think that's kind of my core belief about it. But if I then would look at my kind of personalities, I think that core is like I'm a very, very, very curious person. And I'm really, really interested in figuring out, like understanding how things work out and sort of like taking things apart and understanding it. And generally, I feel like I'm the kind of person that, you know, I like the first 80% extremely much. And then the last 5%, I actually think I should avoid because then I get into like a dopamine circle, which is not too good for me. So typically, I like really like playing games or understanding the stuff where like you play 50 hours and then you get really good at it and you really enjoy it and you're really into it. But then you realize that if you add another 1,000 hours and watch all the YouTube clips and read all the podcasts and listen to all the interviews, you could probably like become one of the top percent. I really try to avoid actually getting to the 1,000 hours because I realize that my mind starts locking in and I stop caring about so many things. And I think when I was a kid, I used to be more like a maximizer and now I'm trying to be a satisfizer. I'm like for myself, I'm trying to let's say this is good enough, really, really good enough. I'm really, really happy where I am. And I really don't want to actually put more effort into getting this more. So I used to have this thing where I pick a topic and I try to just get deep on it. And it could be like, you know, barefoot running. It could be fermenting kombucha. It could be like anything. And I spend 9 months really getting into it and trying to learn as much as I can about it. And then after 9 months, I have to promise myself to let go of the complexity of it. And now I have to do it with routine and relaxation. So now I have to be like trying to move it into kind of a layer where I do kombucha every week, but I don't read much anymore. I don't measure anything anymore. I do it with feeling and I really just enjoy like how I do it. And I try to do that with a lot of things. So when suddenly I get something on my mind where I'm like, oh, how should a fund think about when to sell a startup? Like when, or not to sell it, but like to exit our shareholding and get money back and get really into it. I read a lot about it. I talk to a lot of people about it. And then I try to get out and be like, okay, let's not read about it. Let's actually just now try to just act with a feeling and with a flow and not like be overly analytical every time I'm trying to do it. And of course, I'm taking notes about everything I do and try to document so I can look back. But I think that is like the overarching me is that personality of really, really obsessed about learning and understanding. But also, I tend to become, or historically, I tend to become really obsessive about a thing and to a degree where it is not super healthy for me. So I am extremely disciplined on time. So what this means is that my life looks absurdly strange and boring, that like I get to work before 8, I leave work roughly between 4:30 to 5:30 maybe, and like on very strange days, I'm after work at 5:30, very, very rarely, and come home, cook for the family, eat dinner with my family and like talk to my 3 kids, like, and my wife, like we talk about the kitchen table, do stuff. Then I like, as soon as I've eaten, I'm like slightly antisocial after a while. I take my, either like my laptop or my book or the newspaper or something. And then I actually just have brewed a large cup of tea while we're doing dinner. And I just sit in the chair just next to the dining table. And I just sit there and drink my cup of tea and like read a fiction book. And I'm like part of a conversation, but I'm just trying to like relax into myself. And I really, and I'm trying not to work actually, but trying to just more like do the other things that I like need to catch up with and just like, you know, be me. And like, I am still part of the kitchen table, but I'm not like, if the kids are talking about that kid in school or whatever, I kind of get a like, it's fine. If you want me for anything, I'm like 2 meters away, right? And then I try to like, and then I do usually 1 to 2 hours of work to do like clean up the inbox and stuff. Then I do a lot of stuff with the kids. If it's like certain days, I like, we do a lot of homework stuff or planning stuff or writing exercises or stuff where they want to do or they have to do. And I really enjoy trying to get my kids to want to do stuff. So like wanting them to kind of do daily journaling or wanting them to go running with me or something, or wanting them to do something where it's their drive. So I usually introduce stuff and then I let go and say, you don't do it because to please me, you really do it if you like it. And then if they bounces back and they want to do it, then I'm all in and be like, oh, let's do this. So we play a lot of board games that I really like that are really about balancing long-term and short-term like strategies, which I think is really fascinating. And I try to figure out those things with the kids a lot. And then read with the kids. We read a lot of books together in the evening. Read one chapter out of book each. The kids read for me. Nowadays they're so old, so now they just read one chapter out of book each. And then I try to get to bed and like usually clean my inbox again. And then I just like have a massive long bed routine of, I have like night blinds, pink cushion carpets, weighted blankets, tape my mouth, like a lot of different routines to try to get me to like fall asleep around 11. And then I get up in the morning. And then every weekday, try to look the same. Friday evening is very different because then we like have movie night at home. And then Saturday, Sunday is very much like we got running long distances, like we cook together. It's like, but it's actually extremely like routine-esque in to a degree where I think that it could look extremely boring and rigid, but it is actually that thing that I've gone really deep on a topic. I really, really like how it's done. And now I'm trying to just turn it into a routine. So like, if you would call me on a Saturday morning at 10, you will find me brewing kombucha probably, because that's probably what I'm doing at Sunday, Saturday morning at 10. If you would call me at like 7 a.m. on Sundays, that's when I'm out running. I'm usually running 15, 16K with one of my kids in the morning on Sundays. And it's like, it's just like that routine. And it's I find that my whole body, my whole existence, and also back going back, my whole identity, I feel way more stable when I do this.
Yeah. No, I love how you describe how you basically have to transition from one personality to the other, so to speak, right? But also what resonates with me is that, you know, routines are not just good for being productive at work, for example, but I think they help you to make time for what's worthwhile overall in your life in general, right? Like yet also in your free time. I'm, for example, not a big fan of like sleeping in. Obviously, like if you need to sleep in, right? But like overall, I like having the time on the weekends and knowing when to do what overall, just to make time for what's really, you know, enriching my life overall. So I think that resonates a lot.
I would say that's one of the biggest changes. I would say if you look at me 5 years ago, I think the biggest thing is I get up the same time every day, almost no matter what happened. So like I wake up between 6:30 and 7:05 almost every day, unless I have to catch an early plane or something. And it's like, it's something where if you looked 5 years ago, or it was usually because one of the kids had to do something, it was not voluntarily. It was like, this has to happen before this time. I have to shower before the kids wake up because they're small or something, right? Now it's completely voluntary. And it's amazing because I really find how amazing it is. Because like when it wasn't voluntary, then I try to sleep till maybe 7:30 on the weekends because I felt like I had to be forced to get up at 6:15 on every weekday. And I feel like, no. Like I'm going to have the same wake up time and it's amazing. So I woke up in Paris like yesterday morning, the same time as I always wake up, went out and did a run. And it's just like, I just find it so amazing to go out running in a, like in a city where I haven't been for a while and just figuring out like a route on Strava in the evening before and trying to just, you know, keep that routine, so to say, of my body. And it, like, I really, really enjoy it.
Yeah. I think people got a probably a better impression than they thought they would get of who you are now. Before we get into what do you do for work, because that's what we're mainly here to talk about, is I'd like to ask you, what's that? Because you said you're a very curious person and you explore a lot of different things. Like, when's the last time you've had an aha moment when something like really became clear as day to you?
Oh, I feel like I have those all the time. I really feel like I have those all the time. I think that there's so many ahas on so many different levels. I think that's what I find so fascinating. I think that sometimes I can have an aha when I realize that actually what the underlying motives or structures of an industry or something looked like. Now, I don't mean like technically. I mean, like, I just realized that that's, of course, how they make money. Oh, okay. And then I sort of look back at the whole industry and go like, okay, interesting. Of course, that now I understand why this is changing, and I understand like it's futile that what we're trying to do here. But then I think it can also sometimes be technical, like where somebody says like, oh, this is what's happening with batteries. And then I just feel like, oh, interesting. And then I really like thinking about rate limiters. So like, I mean, bottlenecks is the colloquial term, I guess. So like just looking at it, somebody says like, oh, we need to, I think it's fascinating to think about this. Think about the economy in general, like if you look at it, it's powered, not money now, I mean like energy. The energy economy is powered essentially by fossil fuels. Like we can all say like, oh, there's a lot of other, but let's just like roll back 5 years and then we're all agreeing. So like essentially you have oil and coal and gas and whatever that powers every single light more or less. And some households less, some countries less, but likely ignore that. The coming, like whatever it's going to be, 5, 10, 20, 15 years, whatever, it's going to transition from that to other sources due to many factors, right? And it's crazy to think about the fact that we're talking about trillions of kilowatt hours that are going to go from one kind to another. And it's easy then to just look at the first order being like, okay, we have to produce, instead of producing coal, we have to produce wind power, for example. Okay, but then I think what's interesting is look at the second order to be like, okay, then you have to build wind farms. Wind farms, military have a lot of says about where wind farms are actually. And also, just if you put them in water, it like, how does it actually affect, you know, sea life and everything? Does it? So you get that also. And then you go into supply chains, they're built of composites and we can't recycle composites. We're really bad at it. So like, whoa, I didn't think about that, right? And then you start thinking about, okay, now you generate electricity. Wait, you generate electricity in the middle of the ocean. And also what happens when you don't have wind. We need to get this electricity onto land. And then it, of course, goes up and down, depending on where the wind is. Okay, so for how does that work for a city? Well, you can't have lights go on and off and on and off and ovens go on and off, right? Or the temperature gliding. So you have to store it. How do you store energy like this? And then you have to think about, like, do you store it with, like, really physical stuff? Like, you know, you lift a cement block or water, or do you store it, like, in a battery? Okay, let's say you store it in a battery, chemically then. Okay, now you're storing it chemically in a battery. How do you build those batteries? And then I realized there are batteries that are really quick on load, like, you know, charging and decharging. Like, you know, you can say like, okay, we want this all electricity in, now we want it out. That's kind of what mobile phones gave us, right? They're very compact. They can take a lot in, take a lot out quickly because consumers kind of want to do that. But wait. If you're okay with like having a very slow charging time, but also a very slow time to get it, like, wait, then there are other ways of building batteries. Where are we getting those minerals from? Because if the world is now obsessed by lithium, and lithium mines. Wait, if they're iron-based batteries, then, you know, where do we get iron from? Wait, how do we assemble batteries? And I think that you just go down this tree of something. And I think what I find so fascinating is that every time you ask a why or how, like just a new door opens and it's just like a whole new world. And what I find so fascinating is every single of those worlds have the three circles of like behaviors, incentives and like policies and everything else, and then technology. And if any one of those shifts, like if sort of behaviors change, if incentive change or technology change, this whole like value chain or whatever you want to call it might shift. And I think that's so fascinating, because then you suddenly realize what happens if you integrate that and the factory that, like, if you're a battery factory, do you want to own the critical minerals? Then you integrate that like Apple style, or do you want to like modularize it like in a Wintel style where you have this like collaborations, but anybody, whoa. And then my brain just explodes.
I love how you took that question and basically probably went into like how you do a DD at PayBlue Dot, or like at least what's your thinking process behind a company when you try to understand something.
The funny thing is like, I guess you're going to ask this later as well, but I think that the funny thing is like when we actually do DD, it's way less of this. I think it's like, I think that one of the funny things about how we invest, and I think that how more people should invest when you invest early stage, is way less about thinking, how will we make batteries in the future exactly, like exactly. I think the way I look at it, at least, is that I invest in people going in a certain direction. So for me, most of the conversation is about, I want to understand the people and their like their drives and incentive, but also their clarity and their grit. So for me, a lot of times when I like with the people I love working with, a lot of times they have, of course, they have huge grit. That's the thing is like, I usually say like, I love the honey badgers, like the internet phenomenon. Like, I just love these people who just like, they just like, they can't stop doing something. But I think the other thing I love is when you ask a person a question, I love when they actually can explain something for you or want to explain it for you. So if I ask like, okay, so you're going to do these new iron batteries, explain why. And I think that some of the best people I work with and invested in, they're the people that can explain it as if like I'm an 80-year-old or like I'm a golden retriever or like I'm a 5-year-old. They're just like, okay, this is how you store energy today. And they just talk me through it. And I'm just sitting there fascinating. And I think I find most people underestimate that quality so much. So the funny thing, a lot of times when I do DD, I actually rarely actually go in very deep on actually how batteries are made. Because the funny thing is that it's more like I'm trying to find the best teacher in front of me, listening to them. And I think that it's very, 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 very hard to bullshit people, like if the person asks why. So if somebody says, we're going to make these, like we're making food out of CO2 capture from the sky, I feel like, okay, I get you could make that. It's like, you know, carbohydrates is for God's sake what reading. So it's carbo something. Let's get it. But then I just ask out, what about the energy needs? And it's like when I talk to one of those companies, it's very hard for them to help me figure out like how, because you need so much energy to capture carbon from the sky. But it's like when they say, oh, the food is delicious, I'm like, that is not my question. Like, I don't doubt, like, carrots are also made of carbon, right? I'm asking you how you actually detect economics of capturing from the sky. And I think that at the end of the day, I could, of course, Google and search this and find, like, you know, professors to talk about or whatever. But I find most fascinating just to ask the question as if I was an 8-year-old, just saying, but wouldn't that require a lot of energy? And, like, if they can't explain it to me, then I really doubt them. But if they say, you're right, but in the future we have to, then I have to lean back and be like, okay, do I believe in that we have to or not? That's like my question, essentially. Not technically, can we do it? Because very rarely it ends up being like a technical question. Like, technology can almost solve anything. It's culture that also usually decides if we're okay with it.
Yeah. Thank you for this short excursion, actually. I'm thinking about like what I want to do with you right now, because there are two things that I originally planned. And one was kind of looking, okay, how real is the climate opportunity actually? And then look at what is currently not working in climate in terms of, you know, actually on the operational level, like what kind of malpractices are there? And then look at how can we fix that, right? So I think I'll ask you about the climate opportunity first, because there's this thing in the climate scene as well that kind of drives me nuts sometimes, in terms of basically everybody says, okay, climate is like kind of new internet. There are going to be thousands of unicorns, right? And like I think the most famous thing that probably gets cited a lot as well is this quote by Larry Fink, the BlackRock CEO, and so on, about like, they're going, the next 1,000 unicorns are going to be in climate. And I'm like, that's bullshit. Like right now, today, I looked it up, like approximately 1,300 unicorns around. And many of those at very inflated valuations. Like I heard that Airtable basically is worth less than the money that got invested into it, right? So a lot of these, well, companies just live off the inflated valuations of the past years. So what is your take on how much opportunity is there actually in climate? You know, like how many companies can it sustain? Or take that question as you want, you know, like I guess you have your own opinion.
It's a great question. Yeah, I think it's a great question. And I think the way I look at it is I think you can look at climate in two different ways. I think that you can look at it either as you can either look at it as like the way I think we're trying to look at it mostly, like the essentially future compatible. So like if you one way of thinking about it is like everything we do we have to kind of be able to do it in 2050. Like whatever, like eat, transport, whatever, like, you know, like whatever we want to do. Like if you want to keep doing it, like, you know, in 30 years, how are we going to do it? And then the other question you can ask is that then you can come in with like a diehard, fairly extremist, honestly, not very pragmatic, a viewpoint of like, we have to produce all of our energy with fusion. We have to kind of, nobody can ever eat or touch or anything with animals at all. We have to suck down carbon from the sky. We have to suck down methane from the sky. We have to store it permanently. And the thing is like, and then we have to account for absolutely everything, right? We have to like measure the whole world and like figure out the like every single carbon atom when it's emitted. And I think if you go into the second part, I think that the thing that worries me about that view, which I would say like that, let's call it, I'm just going to call it capital C climate tech, just to make it easy now for this conversation. I don't actually know what it's called. But like the unpragmatic, suck down carbon from the sky, capital C climate tech. If you go into that, I think the headache of that of saying how many unicorns will there be in that industry? The problem is that problem doesn't really, there is no problems. The problem statement is a non-financial problem statement. It's like we have to suck down carbon from the sky and permanently store it. If you just take that problem and we have to measure every single thing in the world to understand where all the carbon is being emitted and used. That problem has no kind of financial connection really yet. And there are a lot of like there are climate bonds and there are a lot of things coming up, the regulation, right? But it's very vague where the industry really, really, really deeply cares about it. And the financial system doesn't care about it deeply. And of course, the behavioral, like, you know, most people, they go out and eat their meat burger and they don't really bother about it, right? So there's so many levels of this, which is like, we ought to do it. Like it's the ought to do climate industry. And then I think you have the other one, which is the pragmatic climate industry. And then you just look at everything around you and you're like, I want to be able to buy a phone in 10 years, a new phone that has something more fancy, right? I want to be able to kind of go to places and have vacations in places. I want to be able to eat nice food and enjoy it, right? And you just go through the list of everything you want to do. And then you realize these things I don't want to do them if they're crazy emitting. I don't want to, and of course, like you can be frowned upon, like, you know, flight shame. You could be like, there's so many levels of the problem, but it could also be regulated that it's super expensive to eat meat or fly or whatever. Or you can have like super pragmatic delay. You can't deliver goods in central Paris with a fossil fuel truck. So then it's like, there are all these levels, which is like, you just look at it and you realize, wait. There's a normal company right now in Paris that wants this delivered and they cannot get it delivered unless it's non-fossil fuel. And I think that what I love about that economy is just like the CFO of the customer of the startup or the corporate, whatever. They're not a climate denier and they're not a climate advocate. They're a bottom line advocate. And the crazy thing about those is you meet these companies that are shifting their fleet from fossil fuel to electric due to maybe like, let's say, Parisian fossil fuel laws. But then they look at the unit economics of their fleet and they go, holy moly, like it's way more profitable to have an electrical fleet. It's way better. And you think about it, just like, again, if you do it in the rabbit hole, if you think about it, it's not that strange. If we think about how we actually get coal and oil, and might be a bit 19th century. So like, let's just say oil. If you look at oil, it's kind of crazy to think about the cost. If you and I landed on this planet now and we had nothing, there was nothing here, and we're going to say, okay, let's say we just colonize a new planet. You and I get to a new planet. We have all the technology we currently have. We're going to build a new planet. None of us would probably say, let's build these massive drills and try to get like some kind of gooey thing, which is very, very flammable and very, very explosive out of the ground, refine it in this super, super complex manner. And every single step here is like super high pressure, super high temperature, and super fucking dangerous, to be very, very frank and honest about it. If you get on your skin, you know, if you breathe it, in fire, everything, right? So like super, super dangerous. Then you get it and then you load it into your vehicle and you're now driving around with a bomb. Like it's one of those things when you start thinking about it, it's like, of course it's going to be crazy costly, right? It's crazy case. And then where do you store it? You store it in huge tanks inside cities underground. So you can go up to a Shell or whatever. And like, you're just like, but then people smoke at those places. That's like bombs inside the city. You're just like, this is madness. So like, then of course you understand the cost coming to this. But then you say like, oh, what if you had a thing on the top, like on your roof that took free energy from the sun, took those electrons and pushed them into your car, that's put it in a solid, like in a state battery, which is chemically like, you know, it's which has very low risk of burning, honestly. Like if you compare it to diesel, right? It's like not very poisonous. And if you open one of those batteries, it's not a liquid, right? Like we're not talking about the risk of you sticking your hand in some poisonous liquid. Then you go like, I think if you and I colonize this planet, Pascal, I think we should do like wind and solar and store it in batteries. I think it sounds safer and cheaper, honestly.
Sounds quite sane. I love how you're describing it because like when I think about what kind of company I would like to found, for example, I try to look for problems that seem ridiculous to me. And it's exactly the same way of thinking that you just exercise, basically.
And I think that's the thing. You can go to almost every single route you can do. If you take meat, you say like, okay, what we're going to do? We're going to chop down the Amazons. We're going to grow corn in the Amazons. We're going to take this corn, strip the corn buds. We're going to ship them to kind of mid-US. And then we're going to feed it to cattle that are packed together, concentration camp style. Yeah. Manure is super dangerous of it because it actually has a lot of other issues. The manure there is like, you know, it creates methane leaks, which destroys, but it's also fairly actually dangerous gases after a while when you get that concentration. You have all these animals moving around, hurting them. You have to kill them, move them around. You know, there's so many practicalities problems. Then you have the meat, you have to slaughter it, like da-da-da-da-da-da. And now meat goes bad after a bit. So like you have to kind of fry it and handle it and whatever. So you put stuff in it to make it better, which are probably not good for humans. And then finally you eat it and people say, ooh, I love my meat burger. Or you just say, you grow the thing on the ground, you take the corn and you eat it. And you're like, what? Yeah, I fry it a bit and I put butter on it. And you're just like, that feels economically way easier, right? There's so fewer steps, so fewer dangers. So one of the things, and I know that people would say, oh, I love the sound of my massive like Bentley V8 car, or I love the taste of feel of burger. I get it. But if you just look at it purely techno-economically, it is like the new behavior makes all sense and the old behavior makes no sense whatsoever. So I think one of the headaches is that, so then you get into the incentives, technology, behavior problem. It's like you have certain industries that are shifting because of behavior. People are like, oh, I don't want to do this the wrong way. I want to do it the right way. And for example, people become vegetarian or vegan. They're just like, oh, I don't want animals around. It just feels the wrong way, right? If I want animals, they're going to be pets and I'm going to love them and hug them. Or it might be technology. Like suddenly you get this chickpea burger with like a very, very nice flavor and like, wow, I can't even feel the difference. It's crazy, right? It's incredible. And a meat eater would say, oh, I can feel the difference. But it's like, yeah, I used to feel that about like oat milk or almond milk or whatever versus cow milk. I used to be like, oh, I can sense the difference. Now when I taste cow milk, I'm like, phew, I don't like cow milk anymore. It's so sour. It's so weird. And then if you look at it incentive-wise, the weird thing is we're crazy subsidizing many of these polluting industries in different shapes and forms. So when those industries, I'm not talking about meat taxes, I'm just talking about not subsidizing these. If you start not subsidizing these industries, the cost of oil and meat and everything would just be so expensive because it's techno-economically complicated. So getting back to your question, I would say, if you look at the pragmatic climate companies, are there going to be trillion-dollar companies in those? Well, are there going to be, is like transportation, food, energy, you know, I can mention industry. Is it a trillion? It's the economy, for God's sake. It's the actual economy of the whole goddamn world. And then you take suck down carbon in the sky and permanently store it. I think it's going to be really big. Do you think you're going to have 10,000 unicorn and trillionaires in that? I don't know. It's really hard to tie that into dollars. So I think that whenever anybody asks me, how can climate tech be so big? I usually ask them, why do you think fintech is big? And they say, fintech? That's different. It's the economy. Yeah, but so is climate. It's the whole economy.
Yeah. And I think what you made quite clear, which is nice, is, you know, this pragmatic versus this rather, let's say, morality-driven climate industry, so to speak, or like a morality-driven view on climate. And this kind of nicely segues into my next question for you, because I would like to, you know, I think it's very easy to say, oh, investing is great, startups are great, entrepreneurs are great, and so on and so forth, right? Like, that's very easy to do. So I would like to look at you very briefly at what's going wrong in the climate scene. What are kind of malpractices that you see? What are misconceptions of climate or whatever, right? Anything that comes to mind. And I think that is one example that we just talked about, basically, that too many people still see climate as a morality-driven kind of cause, rather than being pragmatic about it, being like, hey, climate-friendly ways, probably on a neutral basis, like taking subsidies away, for example, the more economic way of doing things. It's just simply better, most likely.
And I think that another thing which I'd like, so I tend to be an absolutist on things just because I have, like, I think when you ask, I find a, now I'm going to do a segue, I'm going to go back to your question, but I find it fascinating to think about when I think about the most disciplined people I know, and I consider myself a very high disciplined person. The reason I think that I'm a high disciplined person, and honestly, most disciplined people I know, is because they're inherently some of the lowest disciplined person on the planet. So the reason I try to like put a lot of rigor in saying, I'm a vegetarian, when I travel, I try to be a vegan. Whenever I go to dinner, I sign up as a vegan, for example. Why? Because I think that if I put that label on me and saying to myself, for example, I don't drink alcohol. It's easier. Let's take alcohol. I used to not drink alcohol. Then it was in uni and a lot of peer pressure. People were like, you have to drink alcohol. After a couple of years, I caved. I'm like, what the fuck? I'll drink alcohol. Started drinking alcohol. And then I don't know if now 10 years ago or something, I just looked at it and it's like, why am I drinking alcohol? And just stopped drinking alcohol. And then like, I realized that it's way easier for me to say, I drink no alcohol, like zero alcohol, than saying, oh, I just try to avoid drinking alcohol. Because if I say zero alcohol, everything is so much easier. I go to a restaurant and say, oh, do you have like a non-alcoholic tasting menu? And they're like, oh yes, we have an amazing, actually really cool like menu of pressed juices that are flavored and fermented. I'm like, if I would have said just one glass of wine, please. That's it, right? So the thing is that I think it's so much easier sometimes to just be quote unquote hard on yourself and be disciplined and saying, I'm a vegetarian, I'm a vegan or whatever. I don't do this or I never fly or whatever. But the funny thing is that if you take people right now that are vegetarians and you try to get them to become vegans, the effect for climate is not that big. If you take a diehard meat eater and try to like get one day, like the meat-free Monday, if you take every single like preschool or retirement center or whatever you want and just say, on Mondays, we don't have meat, that is a crazy effect. It's like for a preschool or a school, that's 20%, right? Because like it's like one of the 5 days. So I think that this pragmatism, I think that even if I personally need absolutism to kind of figure out how I do shit, I think what I find so fascinating is sometimes I think we try to get the opera singers to sing slightly better opera instead of just getting most people to be able to beat in a rhythm. Like it's just like if you just get most people to just eat slightly less meat and fly slightly less, that effect is huge. And people end up staring at like, oh, look at like how much Bill Gates is flying. It feels like, Yeah. I get it. The 1% is flying like crazy. But the thing is, it's so easy to stare at one of those things and then say, then I can fly. It's like, just try to cut off the worst part of everything, right? Like individual and so on. But getting back to your question, what other things I think? So one thing is like this pragmatism versus idealism stops a lot of people. But the interesting thing, I think it also stops a lot of founders. Like we meet a lot of founders that they come into it from either like they found an opportunity or they're coming in from a moral viewpoint. They say, we have to make this better. I really want to be able to get this mouthfeel or whatever it is, right? Like I we can't hurt animals. I think it's great that people are saying that. And then the funny thing about that is that, or not, it's actually not funny at all, is that many of these founders are pushing themselves so hard and working much harder than anyone else because they have this moral obligation and they feel really, really bad about everything they're doing. So they realize suddenly that, oh no, we use this plastic cup in our production and it's like a 1 milliliter plastic cup that's used like 10 times a day. And it's like, don't bother. Like, just don't bother. Like, it doesn't matter. But they push themselves so hard to be perfect. And I think that perfectionism is like one of the worst things for anybody or anything. But it's the problem is like, you know, if you and I now go to like this amazing, like organic cafe and we enjoy the amazing vegetarian food they have there. And then we realize that one of the teas is not organic. We would be like, what a fucking scam. We were writing all about it on every single review site. And then when we're walking home in the evening, you're like, I'm just going to pop into McDonald's for like a quick bite. I want just a bag of fries. But it's like, ah, we're going in. And then like there's a sign. We stopped having plastic balloons. And both of you are like, wow, McDonald's, they're not that bad. And it's crazy because like we hold the people that say they're good to such a high degree of perfection that is so damaging. And then the people who are like fairly bad, if they do anything, we're like praising like crazy. So I think one strange problem is also if you look at climate funds, people who go out and raise a climate fund, they usually have the problem that they have to adhere to all these principles where a non-climate fund doesn't have to be. And then when the climate fund invests in a startup that say they're a climate startup, then the climate fund forces the startup to report on all these thousands of metrics. And the startup just next door that is, you know, doing whatever, they don't have to report on anything but finance because like who cares about if they're good or bad. So I think that there's so many of these dichotomies and strangeness of the world where you start looking at them and you're like, why are we not like just being honest about how a system works? So I think that's one of the things. And I think that there are so many of them in every single part of the industry of how we treat the climate problem.
Yeah. What you just said resonates a lot with me because like, I mean, I guess you experience it as well, but I experience it as well, like with my family, for example. So I studied a year abroad in Africa. And when I got back, some people were like, especially my family, oh, the sustainability guy, but like flying long haul, right? Like, I was like, yeah, but that's not the point. Like, I went there for a year, A and B. I went there to understand how sustainability works on the African continent in a different context. And it's like, as you say, like holding people with a certain ambition to a higher degree just destroys, I know, like an initial drive that a person, the initial drive a person might have.
And then it's easier to just say, I'm not the climate guy.
Yeah.
Like, right? It's easier. Like, I think that I found that in uni, like one of the reasons I started drinking alcohol was that because people knew that I didn't drink alcohol. Then they were like, oh, let's like, you know, let's try to figure out if we can slip some, you know, vodka into hampas juice. And it's just like, it's then one day I just said, okay, fuck, I'll drink alcohol. Because the second I did, then people were like, oh, chill. Because otherwise they were drunk and they were afraid that I would document stuff that they, you know, because I was sober. And it's just like, take a chill pill. It's just like, you know, can you just please relax? Like, and I think the funny thing is, so like when you're an absolutist or when you put like capital C climate on your sweater, the problem is people are going to pester you a lot for like, oh, tell me how you carbon compensate. And it's like, I don't know. I'm trying. Like, I have no idea. Right. So I think that, so, but then you go back to your question is like, what are the things that like we're doing wrong? I think one of the headaches is that I think the startup and investing is an amazing instrument to solve certain kinds of problems. But I think that 99% of all the problems will not be solved by like neither startups or investing nor capitalism, honestly. So I think that's one of the things which is so complicated about it is I think that we have like an inequality problem, which is huge. We have an infrastructure problem, which is huge. And we have an innovation problem, which is huge. I mean, venture handles innovation fairly well, but not all kinds of innovation. But the thing is, like, it doesn't handle infrastructure whatsoever, and it absolutely doesn't handle inequality. It actually usually makes it worse. So one of the headaches is that I think it's so easy to just think that, oh, no, the cavalry comes. Like, let's just start a lot of venture funds. Let's solve it. But then you get back, for me, to, like, the three bubbles of, like, technology, behavior, and incentives. It's like, there are certain things that just has to be regulated. That has to be like, no, we can't do this because it's obviously dumb. And then there are certain things that we just want people to, like, can you just please not eat meat on Mondays? Like, please do that for me. Like, that would mean a lot to me. And then the technology, a lot of stuff, then VC can come in and be like, oh, shit, we can like, you know, design this from scratch and make it cheaper and whatever. That's great. And I think that the way to look at it is like, if you look at like a Norwegian fjord or like a tree or like a node system or whatever your mental model is, what venture is great at is scouring into further into the network and seeing if there's like a lot of value inside one of these like cracks and crevices that people haven't thought about. Because like what venture does good is like, it ends up like, it's like, you know, financial term, but like you're looking for alpha or beta. Like either you're looking for alpha, which is like the thing that is kind of people that don't, it's like contrarian or whatever you want to call it. Like the thing that most people don't think about is like, so only if you can invent something that now you can do because people want it or technology or whatever, you can do it, right? Or it actually beta, which is like, you just say, how do we index the fact that they're probably going to be more energy storage? So then you're actually not taking a, you're taking a bet, but you're actually doing quote very little like work for the financial industry. You're essentially just saying, I'll borrow some money, I'll lend money and just hope that I get higher interest rates because I'm putting it in the wave instead of against the wave. And I think that what I venture, of course, is the thing that goes out and finds the crazy shit, like the things that people are not thinking about, or that's what it should do. And that, of course, is great when we don't know how to solve a problem. But when we do know how to solve a problem, like which most infrastructure is, venture has nothing to do there. It's like, oh, we should change all the roads like this. We should change the grid. What are venture going to do? Grid planning software? Sure. But like, how big of a problem is that? The problem is like, you need lots of cables and lots of digging and stuff. And should venture build like, you know, should we try to get better, you know, diggers? Yeah, I don't know. I don't think that's probably necessarily the big cost. So
yeah. No, I think that's a great point to make. I think we've talked a bit about the problems in climate. Let's talk a bit about the people who are succeeding in that space and what we can learn from them. And I think we just described, for example, that in my opinion, at least, like one of the most important things that a founder in climate has to do is kind of translate a seemingly morality-driven problem into something that's pragmatic. Just like figuring out, okay, what's the actual like pragmatic opportunity here? Looking at the companies in your portfolio at PayBlueDot that are, you know, raising bigger rounds now, that where you can basically tell, okay, they have traction, they seem to be onto something, like a Overstory raised 25 million, Monta raised 50 million, Patch 81 million. I just picked those. Like, feel free to correct me on the numbers, right? Like, that's what I got from the internet. When you look at the founders behind those companies, what do you think do they get right? What makes them drivers of success?
I think that when you're building any kind of startup, climate or not climate, I think that the thing that most people really underestimate is that there's a very, very hard relay race, which is mostly why startups fail. It's like you need a set of people that can find a problem and find a solution for it that, quote unquote, doesn't have to scale, or, you know, in this, you know, San Francisco, it does not scale. So like the way you're doing it is you figure out like, okay, I can do this and like manually figure out a way to count trees or whatever I'm going to do, right? Like, and then we just believe that technology will be able to do this better than anyone else. And therefore it's going to, the cost curve is going to come down. So it actually is so cheap to count trees or something. And I think that set of people they're fairly wacko. Like that you just think that you can do something and you can like cut the costs like 10 times, like 3 years in a row or something. And it's a very, like, it's a thing that should not work. And then, you know, once every third time it suddenly works. So like you have a high rate of companies that go out and try something and then it doesn't work and they fold and start a new one. So I would say like, it's a lot of like, artistry and like seeing around corners and like squinting and just saying, I think I can see it. It's like, and so that's a very particular kind of skill. And either it's very solution driven. It's like it's a person who has an insight in some technology or something that says like, oh shoot, like this is so much more efficient than anything we've seen. Oh my God. Or it's like actually like a very customer driven sales thing where you think that I can actually talk to customers and figure out this new need when the market shift, when, you know, Paris goes from fossil to non-fossil, how are they going to handle it, right? Like, I'm going to talk to a lot of customers or behavior for that sake. It's somebody like gleaning an insight in something either on the solution side or the problem side. And that is a very, usually fairly non-scalable thing because it's not like a McKinsey report of like top-down analysis of looking at the size of the hydrogen market. That is just like, it doesn't mean anything. It's just like, it's a trillion-dollar industry, but like, of course it is. Transportation is like, you know, it's like, you don't need a report to understand that, right? It's just silly. But the headache is for most people, it's like you have to do that and then you have to shift that into building like a navy. Like you have to go from pirate to navy. So you're this like motley crew of crazy people that are able to kind of duct tape stuff together and get a customer pleased and like, you know, bend every corner what's possible, both on time and hierarchy and structure and like ways of doing work. And then suddenly you need to grow from that team of, let's say, 5, 6, 7 people to like hundreds of people. And the thing is, like, when you're growing that relay race of handling over the baton in time and just becoming like a leader of a massive navy that actually goes out and, like, you know, figures this problem out, that's very rare. Like, it's very rare to find people that go from the motley pirate crew to be able to run a navy. And I think that shift is so hard. So first of all, like, just finding a problem and able to deliver on that promise somehow, even if it's duct taped together and it, quote unquote, doesn't scale, then that is an artistry of in and by itself, which is really hard. But then taking that and actually then building like a whole armada. And the thing is so funny about it, because when you're starting building that massive navy, you start realizing we're going to run out of sailors. We're going to run out of ships. So we need to build wharfs and we need to build schools. And then realize, oh my God, we have to change the land of the sea because we can't park our navy in every single place. So the thing is, like, you have to just start thinking in this very, very structural way. And in the beginning, the people who start companies, they should not think too much in structural ways. Talk to customers, build an ugly prototype, get it to the customer tomorrow again, and let's talk to them again. So that shift is usually what kills everybody. So I think that the startups, I think that actually succeed, they hit a nerve. Like they hit, like they hit the alpha or the beta. Either they hit something which is so unique that people are like, I didn't think that was possible either technically, or I didn't know it existed, or they just hit the beta, which is like, we need to kind of shift to electrical fleets, or we need to charge our cars, or whatever it's going to be, right? And then suddenly, like, everybody says, yeah, we need to. And then this company is just being able to do it better than anyone else. Those, like, the companies that hit beta, they have to be quicker become navies, because they expand so quickly and they have to, like, just figure out a way, because they're not doing anything contrarian. They just have to do it well and scale it. And then the companies that are more of an alpha, they have the headache of how do you scale this thing that people actually disagrees with partly, most people, of course, to something which you can industrialize. And I think, but the skill at the end of the day is the exact same thing. It's like, first, it's all about customers and need. 99% of the time you spend on it. And then it's all about team and customers, of course, but it's like scaling yourself. So I would say those are the magical abilities, which are so rare.
Yeah. I, as you're talking about company building, right? Like I would like to refer to a quote, also looking at the time. I have to be mindful of like what kind of questions I still ask. But another podcast you once said that you're, you know, that you love building companies and that you're not the type for tracking ratios, right? So how does this maybe apply to how a founder should see her or his role?
I think that founders should do, for me, they like, I would say most people in general, their career or their progression stops or starts, I would say it's unlocks when you admit that you're a salesperson. So I think that, I mean, I grew up thinking I'm not a salesperson. I don't want to be a salesperson. I think that I don't want to be a card slinging, bag carrying, horrible person that lies to people. But then suddenly you realize that, wait, if you and I are going to a restaurant and I want to go to the falafel place and you want to go to the pizza place, I'm going to be a salesperson to try to pitch in mine, right? Or I'm going to be a salesperson and let you pick a pizza place so that later we can go to my coffee place. So the thing is that like the day you admit I will do sales and then you try to think about how you actually do sales in a structured way, which is honest to yourself, that's when you're like, you unlock yourself. So I would say that, and first you usually need to become a craftsperson. First you need to do your craft. Like a lot of people just go into sales, but they don't know, they understand the craft and it's like, that's just bullshit. So become a craftsperson so you know how to like write or code or design or whatever it is, right? But then become a salesperson with that in mind. So I think that as a founder, you end up selling to investors. You end up selling to media, you end up recruiting, which is sales, right? So like the majority of the work is going to be that. And of course you end up selling to key accounts. So like you end up just doing sales in different shapes and forms and rallying the troops and aligning everything. So I think that at the end of the day, I think that you have to just become really good at sales. And the funny thing is that if you want to do genuine sales, it's so much about both the craft, of course, of like not the craft of sales, but the craft of understanding the product, understanding the need, understanding the blah, blah, blah. But the other thing is actually just being very like yourself and like being very like calm and like relaxed, because otherwise you can't hear what people are saying. So I think that the founders that are trying to work like 18 hours a day and just crush it and everything, blah, 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 blah. The problem is like, then you can't hear what people are saying. Like you actually have to figure out a way to kind of go out running in the morning and do mindfulness and like, you know, relax, read fiction books or whatever, to be able to be a person that is, can be present, that can actually hear what people are saying or sense the thing where like you just read an article online, you're like, I completely disagree with this. Why do I disagree with this? And it's like, oh, fascinating. But if you're in quote unquote crunch mode, you won't see it. So I think that's one of the things I think it's really tricky is like, how do you handle this relay race of like talking to customers all the time and then scaling team at the same time as you're going to be like, oh, I'm going to do yoga and meditation and run and relax and sleep. It's impossible, right? And that's, I think, is why I like the term unicorn more about the founders than about the companies, because it is your mystical animal. It's almost impossible to handle this. And I think that's why a lot of times I think about this a lot is that some of the best founders, for me at least, are not the ones that are quote unquote broken and like they're trying to fix themselves. It's the people that have struggled and had to kind of overcome adversity, either because they're immigrants and had to come in or because they start off the wrong foot or whatever. And not talking about like broken, but like the people who grew up like in the most comfortable environment and never had to thought about solving a problem, they're not great founders, sadly. But I think that was why I always try to get people when they're saying, I want to start a company, I'm just trying to get them into trouble. So like start a podcast is a great way. It's like start a podcast, interview people. And when you start a podcast, you have to like figure out how to get people online and get to talk to them. You have to figure out good questions. You have to publish them. You just get into trouble. You're like, oh, it's so much easier if I could just play computer games. Yeah, but that's not hard. It's not hard. It's like, it's hard if you want to be at the elite level, but just like doing something that makes you uncomfortable is really, really good. And I think you see that again and again and again and again. Some of the best people we work with are people that had to overcome something and are fine with it being uncomfortable, because that is what the growth journey and the growth mentality looks like.
Hampus, thank you so much. Let's cut it here. This is the wonderful lesson to close with. So thank you so much for taking the time. This was a wonderful conversation, at least for me, and I hope it was for you as well. So
it was great, Pascal. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thanks for asking the question.
Yeah, no, have a great day, Hampus.
You too.